Welcome back to the Weekly Juice Podcast. As always, Ryan and Corey here with the show for you today. If you like what you've been hearing, please like, subscribe, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod. We post daily content in regards to real estate and attaining financial freedom. Today we have on Chad Coach Carson, a real estate investor, podcast host, and author from Clemson, South Carolina. He has over 110 doors and teaches people how they can attain financial freedom through real estate and other vehicles. You can find him at coachcarson.com. I'll say he's been super inspirational for Corey and I, and we're extremely excited to share his story with you so you can grab some information and hopefully it helps you on your journey.
His book, Retire Early with Real Estate, was probably a top two book for me in teaching me the fundamentals of real estate investing. And honestly, we were fanboying a little bit. He's amazing. Some of the value that he brought to this episode, and he's been investing for 18 years and has attained financial freedom. So he's exactly where we want to get to.
Couldn't agree more. Today's episode is also sponsored by Birdie Fitness, a lifestyle apparel and fitness brand founded by personal trainer Colin Masterson. For more information, visit birdie-fitness.com. And without further ado, please welcome Chad Coach Carson. Coach Chad Carson, thank you so much for joining us today. As Corey and I briefly mentioned to you before, we are big fans and have been inspired by you along our journey. And we think our listeners are going to be super excited to hear from you as well. And if you could just dive into a little background on yourself, where you're from, what you like to do, and what you specialize in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun. Really appreciate it. And you know, my background, I guess all the way back in the beginning, I got started in real estate investing sort of as a trial run. I graduated from college. I played football in college. I was just kind of tired. I'm like, I'm not sure I want to do anything else like too organized at the moment. So I just started like jumping into real estate. I had a family member, my dad, who owned rental properties. So I was a little bit familiar with the concept, but I just said, I'm just going to do this for a year or two, hopefully make some money, learn something that'll help me build wealth long run. And then I'll go back to a real job later. And that 1 or 2 years turned into 18 years later, I'm still in the game. And just decided to, instead of, it was a career first just to make money flipping houses. And then eventually a business partner and I also started buying rental properties and trying to build wealth and generate income from that. And that's more where we are today. We have a portfolio of rental properties in Clemson, South Carolina, right where I live as well. It's a college town halfway in between Atlanta and Charlotte in the southeastern part of the US. And it's just had a lot of fun kind of growing that journey of real estate investing and financial independence and learning how to use money to do some fun stuff, do some, you know, things in life that wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
That's awesome. Cool. We were curious on the name Coach and how you got it, because we were just talking briefly earlier before we started recording, and that I coach too. And I feel like when I read your book, that already made me like you automatically. But how'd you get that nickname?
Well, it was another kind of accident thing. Like I started writing a blog. I actually just started doing some consulting with people locally. They were just saying, hey, can you help me out with my marketing campaign? Can you help me out negotiating a deal? And so it's just a little bit of consulting kind of stuff on the side and teaching a class here or there. And as I started, eventually I realized I could write online and do a blog, which was kind of new for me, 2011 and 12. And I just needed a name. And I was like, well, you know, I like sports. Some of the best teachers for me have always been coaches. I like the fact that coaches are teachers, first of all, but then they also take a real interest in the success of their players. You know, the people who play, they've always pushed me, and it kind of goes beyond the X's and O's. It's like they care about you as a person. And so I felt that that was a brand that I could, at least just in the short, I didn't know much about branding at that time, but I'm like, I like coaches, I like sports, let me go with that theme. And it's really grown into fortuitously to something that I think represents my style of teaching and trying to help people just with the X's and O's. And I draw on a little whiteboard and I try to bring that theme of an old school coach who you might have in middle school or high school, who just does it for the passion of it and loves the sport and just trying to help you and help you get better. That's really what I try to bring to it from my standpoint.
That's great, because I coaching is a passion of mine too, and I've always said I want to do it at the high school level because I think it's the purest form of the game where there's not as many other factors that have a play into it. It's just kids that are really want to learn. So I love that about you. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I would say you've done quite a bit of coaching for me, whether you know it or not. I've been using your resources online. I think it's awesome just to let our listeners know you have a blog and then also a YouTube channel. Specifically for me, I visited coachcarson.com. Is that correct? Where people can find you?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, I have a podcast and a YouTube channel and a blog. So all of those are pretty much you can find from coachcarson.com.
Awesome. I highly recommend it. That was an early plug, but I just wanted to put that in there.
Thank you.
Also, you know, I know you're big into financial independence and family. And for us, I researched and figured out you have this Money Life Manifesto. And I was wondering if you could explain that to the listeners and just dive in on, you know, what that is and what it means to you.
Sure. And by the way, like all of this stuff that I share is like me being the first student. Like I'm always the one having to learn this stuff. And so I write about it and share about it just to help me get it. So This is definitely not like talking down from on high to anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the Money Life Manifesto for me is it's a philosophy around money. And I know in my own journey, I've had moments when I get to where like money is the most important thing. And I'm just trying to make as much money as I can. I'm trying to build as much wealth as I can. And I think to an extent, that's a healthy ambition. But at the same time, there's a balance there. And in the Money Life Manifesto, what I wrote about was back in ancient Greece, Aristotle, if you want to dive deep into philosophy, he had this thing called trying to think of the name of it at the moment. I've drawn a blank, but it's basically a happy medium between a virtue. That if you have a virtue, let's say you're courageous, like courage is a good thing, right? But if you're too courageous, you'd go jump off a cliff without a parachute. That's pretty stupid. But if you don't have enough courage, then you're a coward. You know, you never do anything. And so Aristotle's idea was, hey, we ought to try to find the happy kind of medium there. So there's a balance between those things that are virtue. And it came to me that money's kind of the same way. I've been on both sides of that. You could either care too much about it or you could care too little about it. And when you care too much about it, you might get greedy, you might try to take too much, you might try to grab too much, you might spend too much of your time and your effort and your life energy on just making money when really, like, what's the point? You know, like money is just a tool to do other things, to make your life richer, to make it more meaningful, to help people. And so that's, you know, I've been on that extreme as well. But then on the other extreme, you might have people who say, yeah, money's the root of all evil, or money's not important, or, you know, anybody who focuses on money is not focusing on the right thing. Well, you know, that's obviously got its downsides as well, because when you don't focus on money, you're beholden to money. Like you even if you don't like it, you have to work a job to pay the bills. And even if you're very altruistic and you're just trying to save the world or change the world, you got to have money or resources of some kind to change the world. And so there's a happy place there where you try to have just enough, where you're in, everybody's got to find your own place. That's why I say it's something to work on. But I think this applies to real estate investing. I think it applies to financial independence. It applies to your career as well, of trying to find that balance between emphasizing money too much and emphasizing it not enough, so that you can eventually get to the place where money is just a tool, just like a tool in a toolbox, where it helps you accomplish things like freeing up your time, like paying for vacations, like contributions you can make to your community, like all of those things money can do if you put it in the right place.
That's great. I think that your do what matters most is kind of like a root of where that comes from in a way almost, because, and that's what resonated with me most when listening to your podcast and actually listening to your book, because I listened to it on audiobook. But doing what matters most seems to be the reason behind even obtaining all this money. Would you agree with that? Is that, because yeah. I know you have, and sorry, I don't mean to cut you off there.
No, go for it.
Didn't you go and take your family and live in Argentina for a period of time, right? Because you felt like doing that is what mattered most. Spending that time with your family, the real estate that you've built has allowed you to have that time to do that.
Right. Yeah. And that's my business partner and I, in 2007, we did go to study abroad or lived abroad and did that. But I think we came to the realization, my business partner and I did, in 2007, when we got off a little off balance for ourselves, where we were just doing deals and doing deals and doing deals. And we were so busy. We were flipping a lot of houses. And I think we had 33 closings in 2007. And some of those were multiple properties. And so we were just super busy and we had some overhead. And yet 2007, as everybody knows, like their history of economics, you know, that was right before the Great Recession and the real estate was about to tank. And so we, it was a, it was a challenging time as well right after that. And we kind of reflected on it. We're like, why are we, all right, we're doing all these flipping. We're really busy. We've made some money. We've done some good stuff. But like, if we had, we actually did an exercise where we wrote down, like, what are the things that we would do if we had, if money was not an issue? If you just like wipe money clean from the table, just write down what you would do with your time if you had no restraints. And for me, it was like, I would play pickup basketball in the middle of the day. I would take hikes here and there to the middle of the day. I would go on trips, and I met my wife. I got married in 2007. And so we really love studying abroad or traveling abroad, learning foreign languages. She teaches Spanish. And so we imagine, you know, one day maybe we'll have kids and we'll have get to travel with them. And so these activities, some of which cost no money, like playing pickup basketball in the middle of the day, the only restraint for that was me having the flexibility and time to do it. It had nothing to do with money. And so when you start prioritizing those, all of us have different things, but I've been asking people over the years, like, what matters to you? What matters to you? And very often there's a quantity of money surrounding it. Like a trip costs 15,000 bucks for to go for 4 months, maybe. But that's like a car, you know, people buy cars for that kind of thing. And yet you could have this life experience of changing the trajectory if you start quantifying what it takes to do the things that matter to you. And very often you just need more time. That's the common thing we came to in 2007. We were like, wait a minute, like if we make $500,000 a year or $1 million a year and we have no time and flexibility and we're kind of chained to this desk of having to do this job, you know, what's the point? Because the things we want to do don't cost that much money. And so that was really an aha moment for us where we started trying not only to make money and build a portfolio, but also build it in a way that is conducive to the goals we have and what matters to us. And so that's what I try to convey to everybody else too, is that, you know, all of us are individuals. We have different things that matter to us. And if you want to go build a 1,000-unit apartment empire or something, like, that's all good. That's cool. I'm glad somebody does that because that's part of entrepreneurship in the US. But many people I talk to are kind of like I was, where they say, well, the things that matter to me are working in the garden, playing pickup basketball, traveling, spending more time with my kids. And my message to them is like, well, you only need like 5 or 10 properties to do that. Just get them paid off and you can get 5,000 bucks a month and pay your bills. And there you go. So that message is not given very much. And that's one reason I've tried to make it my, you know, my message, like, hey, do what matters, go smaller, go home. Don't worry about, you know, having 1,000 units, just have enough so that you can do what matters to you and then enjoy life, have fun.
That's a perfect segue. Yeah. If you want to jump into the next thing. Cause it's like, it's kind of, I think what we see, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think we like nice things, but there's a certain point where having more doesn't make it any better. Right.
Yeah,
but
we talk all the time, specifically on our podcast, about time versus money or money versus time. What's more important to you? And I think you explained it perfectly. It's like, you don't need all the riches in the world to be able to do what you specifically want with your life. I know you talk specifically in your blog about this, but I was wondering if you could share with people, what's your idea of how you think people sell out for money? Or what is that mantra that you created?
Yeah, it's related to that Money Life Manifesto that, and we all do this, by the way, like we all sell out a little bit. It's when you slide a little too far down the scale where you're working a job, for example, that makes a ton of money, but it doesn't make you happy, or the role you're playing in that career isn't making you happy, or the schedule you're keeping doesn't make you happy. You're selling out because there's a disalignment. You know, it's not aligned with what is important to you and the way you would do it. If you could just write it, if you could write this job description exactly the way you would want it, you wouldn't do it that way. And so my definition of selling out is anything you would do if you didn't need the money, would you do this thing that you're doing in the same way you're doing it right now? And if you can't say, yes, I would do it, you're selling out a little bit. And that's a little harsh way of saying it, you know, because a sellout, nobody wants to be a sellout. But, it's kind of a wake-up call, because I've been there too. It's like, if you want to shape your life and put it in a direction, sometimes we just got to wake up. We all get comfortable. And especially with money, we get comfortable, we get used to having it. When in reality, it's kind of like when you start moving towards financial independence, I've equated it with kind of like when you're a teenager or you're a young kid and you're like, what am I going to be when I grow up? Like, what am I going to do? And you remember how, like, when you do that, you're sort of dreaming about the future and you're optimistic and you're like, and I could do anything. Like, I could be, you know, I could be an astronaut, or I could be a scientist, or I could be a professional basketball player. well, I think we lose some of that. I know I did. And you kind of get squashed down a little bit. And I think if you think about money in this way, that it's just something that opens up possibilities and you don't have to sell out anymore for money. You know, what do you want to do when you grow up? You might be 40 years old. You might be 50 years old. But like, what do you want to do? Like, your life is in front of you. And if money wasn't an issue, you know, how would you spend it? And that's it's pretty scary sometimes, but it's a pretty cool thing to think about.
It can be, but when you realize it, like I realized that when I was 23, and I'm only 28 now, but I took a job out of school that I was like, oh, I'm going to be, it was an insurance, and it's not knock on insurance. We all need it. It's great. Just not for me. And I was like, I'm going to make all this money. And then I was like, literally like 4 weeks into the job, I was like, this sucks. Like, I hate it. And I knew that it was the end there. Yeah. I don't know how much longer I ended up staying, but I knew that was the end of that job, but it framed it to me. I was like, I don't need this, the whole money thing. It doesn't matter if I wake up and I'm miserable at my job. It literally doesn't matter to me. So I think it's a good segue, because you figured out that real estate could afford, that was the vehicle that could afford the life that you wanted to live. So when did the light bulb go off for you that was the case, that you knew you could get to this life through real estate?
It sort of took a couple phases for me with real estate. And I was fortunate enough that my dad had rental properties. So he had some books on the shelf. He had, when I was in middle school, like 10, 12 years old, he used to take me and my brother to his fixer-upper houses that he had bought at foreclosure. And he would drop us off and say, hey guys, clean up this refrigerator with all this old food in it, and I'll be back in 3 hours. And he would just like leave us there at the house. And we would complain about it. Man, what are you talking about? This is awful. And I hated real estate at that point, but it was really good. I'm glad he did it, because it kind of gave us the dirty part of the job first, and it kind of pushed me away from it for a little while. But once I was in college and I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life, it came back to me because I had that example, fortunately. But the first phase of my real estate career was just making a job out of it. I just had to make money. And so I learned how to find deals and fix and flip houses, how to get the money to acquire those properties from private lenders, because I didn't have a job. I was a 23-year-old kid right out of college with no job. So I had to get creative to find the money. So all of that phase one was, how do you put a business together that makes money, buying and flipping houses. And it was successful enough over time that I was able to pay my bills and save some money with my business partner. And then we started moving into phase two, which is, at some point, it's just another job. You're just flipping houses is just a job too. So we wanted to start planting seeds with long-term buy and hold properties, and also some owner financing and some other kind of income generating strategies within real estate, so that we could, it's kind of like a farming metaphor. Instead of just having cash crops where you grow the crop and you have to eat it every year, we also had these fruit trees that we grew, and they took a little time to develop, but you know, once those rental properties developed, and you can start picking that fruit, and it keeps on going for years and years and years and years. And that's what I see with buy and hold rental properties. They really bloom and develop over time, to the point where then you can spend a little bit of time, like my family and I didn't talk about this earlier, but we went for 17 months to Ecuador in 2017 and 18. And I was spending probably an hour per week, most weeks, just doing bookkeeping and staying in touch with my property managers. And yet that paid for our entire trip. Like, that hour per week and the work I'd done ahead of time paid enough for us to go live abroad and you know, pretty much indefinitely. So that's the kind of transition we went to in phase two, to income generating assets.
To give people a little bit of context here, because we're going to dive pretty deep here in real estate, can you give people an idea of what your current portfolio looks like?
Sure. Yeah, I'm in a college town. So a big chunk of our rental portfolio are student rental properties. So we have, there's a whole spectrum of student rentals, but we have more like the affordable student rentals. So people who are typically paying their own way through college, or they're a grad student, or they're a couple who got married and they're going back to get their PhD or something. We rent to a lot of those people. So typically older properties that we fix up and clean up and then rent out. So those are small multi-unit properties, like duplexes, fourplexes, sometimes a little bit, a 12-plex, a little bit bigger. So that's one chunk of the portfolio. And then we also have others that are just like single family houses, some mobile homes, have about five houses that we financed to other people. We bought them, fixed them up and sold them, and then carried back the financing. We were the bank for them. So we essentially getting interest from them as well. So we have a variety of things, but those are the examples of what we do now.
Cool. And you said are all your properties in the Clemson area?
Pretty much. We within 20 minutes, but I'd say, you know, 75% are right in Clemson, Central Pendleton, which is an area with a, probably 3 square miles from this Clemson University.
So you're in the dozens of properties at this point in that area, which can, to some of our listeners, are probably like, wow, like that must have taken forever, or all this work that goes into it. I'm curious, how long was that process to get there? And if you could just maybe turn back the clocks a little bit and talk about maybe your first, even if it's not your first flip or your first buy and hold, but one of your first deals and how you strategize about going about that.
Yeah, that's a good point, because where I am 18 years later, we have 110 units. Like that's, yeah, that jumping from zero to that is like impossible. You know, it's a stair step. I've been doing this full time for 18 years, and the stair steps were the first 3 or 4 years we were investing. You could think about it like the equivalent of having a job. Like we weren't building that much wealth. We were just making money, building our knowledge. And then a couple years into it, we did buy one rental property, and we bought a property where the seller ended up financing the property to us. So we made a down payment to the seller, and then the seller agreed, instead of getting all their cash up front, they agreed to let us make monthly payments to them over time. It's called seller financing. Yep. And it's not the most common way of investing in real estate. Most people have, you know, go get a loan and a mortgage, but it was the way we had to do it, actually, because again, we weren't the best, most bankable people. We had good credit, but we didn't have any sustainable income that we could prove and document early on. So that was our first opportunity, because we were out there finding deals to flip and to send to other people and wholesale to other people. Every once in a while, we would cherry pick one that made sense for us to keep as a rental property. And it just started with that one. And then the next year, maybe we got a couple more. And then you know, probably 5 or 6 years into the business, then we had 2007, the year I talked about earlier, we really turned it on and flipped a lot of houses, but we also kept a bunch. I think by the end of that year, we had 50 rental units, and kind of jumped from like 5 or 10 to 50 in 1 year. And that was too much. Like that's like eating Thanksgiving dinner and then having another Thanksgiving dinner right after it. That was not smart. Yeah. But and then eating Thanksgiving dinner right before a pickup basketball game, which was the Great Recession. That was bad news. but we worked it out. We got the indigestion taken care of. But that was how we kind of, a lot of it had been building ahead of time, and then we just shot out of a cannon 1 year. And then over time, it began grow. You know, we took another leap in 2014 and 15, where we bought a big, you know, a lot of some multi-unit properties. So it kind of goes like that sometimes. You go flat, just one or two deals. And then if you're in the business full time, you might, for some people, that might be 3 or 4 deals at a time. For us, it was, you know, dozens of deals at one time.
Rye has a question here. I just wanted to make sure I clarified this. The flipping was fueling your business, right? Was fueling your rental business. That was how you were getting them, because you didn't have a 9-to-5 at that point, right?
Yes, okay. full-time flipping. That's all I did. I was out making offers, sending out letters, talking to realtors, talking to homeowners. That's all I did every day, all day.
Awesome.
So we hear from a lot of different types of investors. And for me, it's hard to paint a picture of a day in the life. I think a lot of people, I'm more segueing towards systems and how you operate your business. I'm curious if you could dive into that and just give people a preview of maybe like what programs you use. I know you mentioned property manager, but just sort of an idea on how the well-oiled machine is running.
Yeah, I love this question because we were lucky. One of the first books we read when we first started our business was a book called The E-Myth. I don't know if you guys have heard of that one, but it's all about systems, and it's all about, even if you're a tiny little business, if you're like a business of one, one property or not even a property yet, he recommended that you always build your business as if you're a big company that has systems and operations manual. And we actually, my business partner and I were sitting in the living room. I can vividly remember this. We had no properties yet, and we assigned all of the different roles within the business. We're like, hey, you're the bookkeeper, you're the CFO, you're the CEO. We didn't even know what these things meant, really, but we were like, this is what it says to do in the book. So we drew this little chart and put our names next to them. And I think what that taught us, though, was that this business has a life of its own. It's a system, it's an organism almost, and that we are the people kind of running these systems, but eventually we want to outsource those systems to other people, at least part of them. And if we want to do that, you got to create things like checklists, or you got to create a best practices. This is how we collect rent. This is how we pay our bills. This is how we organize our annual reports. You know, all of those things take time, but what the message of the e-myth was, you, when you're working in the business, when you're doing all those things, also take a little bit extra time and take the time to work on your business, kind of like from above, to try to build those systems. And so that was something we took to heart, and we've had an operations manual for years, and it's evolved and we're growing. But the way our business, I guess, looks now, I'll go backwards in time from here. We have property managers who do most of our day-to-day kind of work. So we have a few different property managers who do the leasing, the rent collection, the maintenance calls. But we're still kind of driving that ship from afar. So they ask us questions. Like, for example, here's a particular system. If we get a maintenance call, they have authority from me that if it's less than $500, I want them to go ahead and make a decision.
It's the third person we've heard that from, by the way.
Oh, yeah? Is that a good tip? Yeah. Okay.
500 is a good barometer.
Yeah. Chris from the Stealthy Rich. I don't know if you've ever interacted with those guys. Cool. They're awesome. But they said the same thing. Like, if it's 500 or less, just
do it.
Just make it happen. Yeah.
And it's kind of like coaching, you know, if they make a mistake, which is going to happen, you're a human being, you need to pay attention and give them feedback. So, hey, when you spent that $400, I probably would have tried to go get a different refrigerator or different stove, you know, like that was, it was a little unnecessary to buy that kind, but you give them feedback because the point is to let people have autonomy to do something within the framework of your system. And so that's what we've tried to do now. And the roles we play now are, we're the asset manager. We're the people who acquire properties, sell them. We make kind of bigger picture decisions on capital expenses and replacing this roof or not. But they make the day-to-day decisions on, all right, we're going to rent to that tenant. We're going to do that maintenance call. And it's a really nice place to be. Like, I'm really appreciative of once you get some good people in place, that again allows you to step back from the business, be on a podcast like this while they're out there doing some kind of remodel. And it's allowed me to get my time to do other stuff. But it all started early on with that decision to build systems, because originally what we did was my business partner and I did everything 100%. You know, I was calling the tenants. I was the one talking to contractors. He was talking to contractors. I was the acquisitions guy. I was paying bills. He was paying bills. And we still pay the bills today, by the way, most of them. I don't want to outsource that. Yeah. But we, over time, had those systems that we outsourced to a bookkeeper. We outsourced some things to contractors, and eventually, you know, much more of it to managers. And that's what, that step right there is key, because that allows you to travel, that allows you to do other things. And the mistake some people make is they do everything themselves, which is fine at first, but they do it without an exit clause. Like they don't pay themselves a management fee, or when they analyze the numbers on the rental property, they don't put that 10% for management fee, because, oh, I'm doing the management, I don't need to pay myself. Or I'm doing the maintenance, I don't need to pay myself, just to make the numbers work. But then they get trapped to that deal, because they can never pay anybody else to do it. And we were sort of lucky in that respect. I'm not handy at all. Like, I can't fix anything. So I had to hire people to fix stuff all along. And that's allowed us to not be kind of bogged down in the day-to-day fixing of stuff at properties.
Yeah, that's me too. I'm not handy at all. And Rye's probably decently handy, but the whole point is I don't think we want to be doing that stuff. And we just started formed a partnership and are acquiring property slowly here. But I'm wondering at what stage you were at when you fully turned that over to a property manager, because that's, I think, the question that a lot of new beginning investors are going to have. Like, well, I don't know if I can afford to do that upfront. And we don't think we can either. We think that maybe 5 years, 4 years, just as a ballpark, we put it in our numbers, and then we know, and at that point in time, we may be having less cash flow coming in, but the numbers still work. And then we can have that autonomy to give the job to somebody else.
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I think it is not wrong to work harder in the beginning and keep that money for yourself. Like, I think that's smart, because it's kind of like the story of, you got to sweep the floors of the store when you first get into the store business. Like, you want to do everything if you can, because then as soon as you outsource that stuff, now you say, well, I've done that. Like, I know how long that took to fix that, you know, toilet, to put the wax ring on the toilet. Like, I've done that. That's not a big deal. And so I think the first 3 to 5 years doing some stuff yourself is fine. If you're not handy, like I wasn't, you can start outsourcing it from the beginning. Like, that's great. But especially if you're doing management yourself early on, that allows you to see what the process is like, how to screen tenants. And then once you outsource it, you're not just handing it over to somebody and saying, hey, just hope you do well. Like, you're actually asking them questions. How do you screen tenants? How do you turn over tenants? What's your checklist? Do you have a system? And if they say, no, we just kind of find a good tenant and whoever seems best, like, no, like that's the wrong answer. Like, you want to have they need to demonstrate to you that they've done it to a level of competence that you've done yourself. And that's a really, I think that's why it's important early on to do it yourself so that you can learn. And also so you can build up some cash, because cash is always tight when you first start. And so you might need to build up reserves. You might need to, you'll make some mistakes. Like I made so many mistakes, still make mistakes every once in a while, to have where you're over budget on stuff. And so if you're managing yourself, it allows you to recoup some of that capital and overcome some of those early mistakes that you're bound to make.
Yeah. Like we're allowing our 9-to-5s to pay for our, we have 9-to-5s, we're allowing that to pay for our investments. So once we purchase an investment, right now we're doing conventional. So when you put the 25% down, mm-hmm. we're not at a position to where we just, that money builds up again. Like it'll take some time. So I think it is important to have some of the money stay in our pockets for the first couple of years, but we intend fully on having it be systematized so that we can hand it off to someone, right?
100%.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of conflicting answers here, and I'm curious your thoughts on purchasing properties within an LLC versus under your own name. I'm not sure how you and your partner do it, but would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, we do it under an LLC, but I get the fact that the biggest challenge for not putting an LLC is typically the conventional financing, because for them to give you a loan, they want it in your own name. So I think that's reasonable. Like this gets into like legal questions of, you know, liability and what's more important. But I think in business and real estate and entrepreneurship in general, there are always trade-offs. There's always going to be like, there's a benefit to this action, but there's also a cost. And to me, the biggest risk in real estate investing, not that liability from a tenant suing you is not a risky thing, but the biggest risk is bad financing. It really is. Like the people I've seen several people go out of business because they have bad loans. And I've seen very few, if any, that I can think of go out of business because they got sued because they didn't have the right LLC or something.
So can you give us an example of like what you would mean by a bad loan? I'm curious, because are you just talking about a high interest rate?
High interest rate or a balloon note or something like that. And so why that's relevant here, I think, is if you can get a 30-year fixed 4%, 3% loan, that's the best thing you can do to reduce your risk. Yep. And so I think that whatever you got to do that, whether that's putting in your own name, for example, I think that's smart. I think that makes a lot of sense, because you're eliminating one of the biggest risks, which is having bad financing. And let me demonstrate, like bad financing where some people went out of business. The best example is actually Dave Ramsey, I think. Dave Ramsey, back in the late 80s, my understanding of the story was he bought a lot of rental properties. And very much like what we're talking about here, he had a portfolio of rentals, bought them on good deals, and he used a lot of commercial loans. And so he went to a local bank or a commercial bank, and they gave him loans that had these big, thick packets saying all these, like, kind of the fine print of how things worked. And it turned out that the fine print said if there was ever a big real estate crash or there's ever a big financing challenge in the market, we have the right to go give you 30 days notice and say, pay us all our money back. Wow. Was an acceleration clause. And there's also other things called balloon notes where 5 years later, 7 years later, you have to pay everything back that you owe, even though it's a 20-year loan or a 30-year loan. Whatever you owe in 5 years, that's one big $100,000 or $200,000 check you got to stroke. And stroking $100,000 or $200,000 checks that's risky. That's really tough. I mean, you could deal with $100 negative cash flow for a long time. That's got like getting a little cut on your arm. You know, you could keep putting a Band-Aid on it and deal with it. But $100,000, $200,000 check, or in Dave's case, like a $3 million portfolio of loans where they said, pay us back in 30 days.
I always wondered why he was so against debt, and now I know. I never knew that. That's crazy. We think that the 30-year, I mean, first of all, interest rates right now are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long they're going to be like that, but we think 30-year fixed is like you almost can't go wrong as long as you're buying the deal right.
Absolutely.
But I think that one of the things that I learned from you specifically is the rental debt snowball. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was so cool, because that is the whole story of why you don't need 100, 200, 500 rentals to become financially free. Do you have a mix of paid off properties? And if so, can you just explain the rental debt snowball for everybody?
Sure. Yeah. So the rental debt snowball is similar to like people use with their personal finances, where let's say you had five credit cards or student loans, you would just line those up and you would say, I'm going to save all of my money. And instead of me paying a little bit down on each of those properties, I'm going to put 100% of my savings as much as I can on one property at a time or one debt at a time. And because you're doing that, you pay it off a lot faster. Instead of like 10 or 20 years, you're paying it off in like 2 years or 6 months. And then that frees up the payment on that one debt you just paid off. And now you add that to the snowball and you attack the second debt. And then that gets paid off a little bit faster. And then you attack the third one. And so that same principle that works in personal finance, you could also use as a tool in real estate investing. And it's particularly a good tool if you think about your investing career as like in phases. And so like for us, we were in the acquisitions, the load up phase for a number of years where our whole goal was to use as little of our cash as possible on the acquisitions, get in using a lot of leverage. And that could be, has its pluses and minuses, right? But we, you know, get the best, safest loan you could with the best leverage you can on the best properties you can. And you load up to whatever level you need. For some people, that's 5 properties. Some people, that's 10. Some people, that's 50, you know, in our case. But you load up. And then you transition to a phase where you're going to deleverage and where you're going to reduce risk and you're going to increase income. And the pushback I always get for that from the people who are the spreadsheet nerds and say, well, I know how to optimize the best returns is like, you're paying off a 4% loan or a 5% loan or whatever. I can make a 10% return in the stock market, or I can make a 20% return with real estate. Why would you even consider paying off something that low? Well, the point is that you're not trying to grow forever. You are balancing growth with risk. Growth with risk. So there's a trade-off there. And at some point, if you start deleveraging some of your portfolio and you use like a debt snowball, for example, you start using some of your cash flow to start paying some debt off instead of just growing, all of a sudden that $600 mortgage payment you had is now freed up. And you now have increased your cash flow by $600. And you do the next property and you free it up by another $600 or $700. And you can get to this plateau. And maybe you don't do all your properties. Maybe you do like 2 or 3 or 4. And that's sort of where we landed. We didn't want to pay off 100% of our properties, although we might do that eventually. We still have some private debt, still have some seller financing debt. We kind of wanted to find a balance between having some leverage, because if we have inflation and we have future growth, we think it's beneficial to have some leverage. But we also didn't want to be a mature real estate company and be leveraged to the hilt, because what happens if we have a Great Depression or if we have, you know, deflation where rents drop by half or 50%, you know, you're going to have a lot of trouble if you're 100% leveraged in your whole portfolio. So I think a smarter long run, if you pay attention to like Warren Buffett and other investors who've been around for decades and decades, they pay attention to risk just as much or more than they do return. And debt snowball is one of the perfect tools in real estate to go transition from that growth phase to the more stable, you know, phase that you can live off of and kind of sustain yourself for a long time.
Yeah. I heard a strategy the other day that was talking about putting every property, buying one property a year for 15 years and putting them all in 15-year notes. And then by the time you get, maybe I heard it from you, actually, I'm not sure.
Oh.
By the time you get to the 15th property, the purchase, the first one's paid off. Now, I would rather do 30-year loans, but to me, waking up to 20 free and clear properties or 10 free and clear properties, it's kind of just like, I'm all about cash on cash return, but talk about a safety net for yourself, mm-hmm. right? I think if you and I had 20 properties and we could get to a point where 5 is free and clear and 10 are on 50% around that, and then the other 5 are 25% leveraged, as you start to pay those down, the cash flow numbers just get higher and higher. And I don't think that you would have to care as much about your cash on cash return at that point. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cash on cash return matters the most early in your career, because you want to compound early on, because that growth return really, really matters. The longer you get, I mean, return still matters if you want it, but at some point, like, you're going to have a bunch of equity, because if you've done things well, you bought 20 properties, you know, each one of those maybe has $30,000 or $50,000 in equity. And yeah, you know, you start multiplying that out, your net worth is looking pretty good right now,
but you can't do anything with it.
You can't do anything with it. Yeah. The risk you have is, what happens if we hit a calamity? What happens if things change? And I think the most important investing lesson, this comes from Nassim Taleb, the guy who wrote Anti-Fragile and some of those other books about, is the future is uncertain. Like, I don't care if you find somebody who seems so smart that they've got it all figured out for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years, you need to run the other direction, because they don't know what they're talking about, because nobody does. Like, it's even if you have an 80, 90% probability that's going to happen, the more important question as an investor is that 1 or 2 or 3 or 10% chance thing happens, is that going to wipe you out? Because if that very rare thing has a very big effect on you, you're going to get wiped out in that case. And you're going to have everything, you know, that you worked for go undone. That's why we have insurance. That's why I just had a fire last week, which was horrible. But we have insurance, you know, luckily, you know, knock on wood. I hope that all works out. It's kind of that kind of thinking. You got to think like insurance with your portfolio as well, that what's the worst thing that could happen and could I sustain that? And as a brand new investor, we're all brand new babies at some point. You can't worry about like falling out when you don't own anything yet. Just go ahead and start growing. And if you slide back a little bit, cool. But once you get to a portfolio, a platform, 5-10 years in, you need to start thinking about risk reduction a lot more. And that, again, I'm going back to my original point. The biggest risk you have is not making your mortgage payments, because then the bank will take all that away from you. That's the biggest risk. And so if you mitigate that by balancing with 30-year debt, fixed interest kind of debt, and then also paying off some of those properties, you're really going to reduce your chances of having a calamity, you know, wipe everything out.
Really cool advice. Really cool.
So you mentioned phases a couple of times here, and I just want to paint a picture for everybody listening. I believe these are kind of in connection with your five stages of wealth stages, the financial independence. Can you go into those and maybe it'll give people an idea of where they're at and where they could jump sure. to?
Yeah. So this helps me think about it, to think about your journey in real estate investing and financial independence, like you're climbing a mountain. So imagine if you're a brand new beginner, you're down at the beginning of the mountain, you're at the base of the mountain, you're kind of looking up at the peak and you're like, man, that's financial independence up there. That's way up there. I'm not, you know, I can't even fathom how I'm going to get to that top of Mount Everest. You know, that's just way up there. And so you got to, instead of thinking about making that leap from the bottom to the top, start thinking about it in phases. Like you're just going to take some baby steps. You're going to go from one step to another. And financially, the way I thought about it was you could call it five stages. So let's say the very beginning, your goal is just to survive. You got to get financial oxygen. And this is in the stage, if you got debt, if you're just trying to get your bills paid, if you're digging yourself out from a situation that caused you some financial pain, like most people have been there. Like, unless you had a trust fund when you were a kid and just laying on your lap, I mean, all of us have gone through that stage where we're just like worried about putting food on the table. There's some urgency to us. And your job there is just to do that, put food on the table. Stage number two is getting to a phase of stability, where instead of just surviving, you have an emergency fund. Maybe you get some of your personal debts paid off. You don't have a car loan or you don't have a bunch of credit card debts. That kind of gets some of the pressure off of you. So again, you're kind of like financial oxygen. You're breathing a little bit easier and you can think a little bit easier. You can start kind of thinking about the future and where you're going to go. So that's number two, stability. Number three is, if you ever really want to move towards financial independence, you got to start saving money. And so you can't just be stable. You've actually got to build a gap between the money you make and the money you spend. And the larger that gap is, the more you can build that gap and increase that gap, the faster you're going to move up the mountain. And so that's what it's all about in stage three. And this is where, like, the reason I love house hacking so much is that it reduces your biggest personal expense, which is housing. It's like 30% for a lot of people. Sometimes in higher cost of living areas, it's 40 or 50% of your income goes to housing. So if you can eliminate 30% or 50%, you just increase your savings rate by 30 to 50%, from 30 to 50% of your income. That's a big, big deal. And there are other ways to do that. You know, usually, you know, I know saving money on lattes and coffees, like people talk about that some too, but I think if you take care of housing, if you take care of your car, like I've always driven used cars, like always, I'll probably, you know, at some point we'll break down and do something brand new. But right now I just can't, I still get returns and I'm still paying off debt. I can't buy a brand new car. So if you could take care of your housing and your car, and then maybe groceries, food, things like that, be a little smart with that. Those three things will eliminate a big chunk of your expenses and allow you to save money. And if you add in there also trying to work on getting raises, side hustles, flipping some houses, you know, you can't just do it on expenses. You've actually got to make more money too. But all that is phase three. And then phase four is growth. And this is really the traditional investment stage. So this is where you save capital. Maybe you got $100,000 saved up, $50,000 saved up. What do you do with that savings? What do you do with it? You got to turn that $50,000 into $1 million. That's the goal of phase number four. And then phase number five is the final one on my chart. It's where you're trying to go from growth, where you're just grow, like the acquisitions phase we talked about earlier. And you're transitioning into a phase where you want to live off of your assets. either part of your assets, maybe you're fully retiring, you know, whatever your case might be, it's a different game. It's a different play. You're not just maximizing growth. You're worrying about risk. You're worrying about income. You're worrying about the stability of your portfolio. Is it diversified enough? That's something where I'm still evolving. Like most of my properties are in one location. You know, we're not an earthquake zone, but like we do have, you know, we had the quarantine and we had, you know, what happens if Clemson University goes out of business? I don't think they will, but if it did, I would be in trouble. So that's here I am. I'm at risk. I have an exposure that has one cause that could kind of put me out. So I need to make sure I'm diversified in different locations, different types of assets. And so diversification is a really important investment word early on too, but especially as you're kind of getting towards the top of the mountain and you want to make sure you keep all that money that you've built over the years.
Yeah. So I want to ask you a question on how long it took you to get from the bottom of the mountain to the top. And then I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. How long did it take you to reach financial independence?
I think when I fully like realized my business,
like once you were like, this is what I should do.
I think that really for me, it was 2017 where I think maybe it might've been a little earlier in practical sense. Maybe it was 2013 or 14, like 13 years in or 10, 12 years into my journey. But I think it was 2017 when I took that trip to South America and I was like, all right, I feel pretty good here. We're probably okay a couple of years before that, but that was where we really realized, all right, we're in pretty good shape.
So if you're talking about 14 years to get from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain, when the alternative is to work 40 years to retire when you're old and gray and you have trouble walking, or you're just a little bit enjoying the things that you like to do, like hiking and playing basketball, becomes more difficult, then the mountain really isn't even that high as long as you make the sacrifices early on. Yeah. Would you agree?
I agree. Yeah. And I was pretty aggressive with it. You know, I save a lot of money. So, I mean, the thing I love about this is it's so flexible depending on your personal preferences. Also, I need to say something about like starting lines. Like, if we were training for basketball and we were racing each other on the court, you know, in reality, like some people got a head start. Like I got a head start. Like I had a scholarship in college that had no college debt. I had parents who were financially in a good situation, who gave me lots of skills. So like, I just want to acknowledge for all the listeners, like don't beat yourself up if it takes you 20 years, if it takes you, you know, like you can't, I think you comparing yourself to me or any of us comparing ourselves to each other is kind of toxic because I don't know your story. Like I don't know all the obstacles and the journeys that somebody had to overcome to even to get to zero, like to get to a zero net worth. So that's the first comment I want to make is just that it's not a race, but the optimistic, the hopeful thing for everybody is if you really focus on this, particularly with real estate investing, I think it's the vehicle that gives you the most control over the timing of this. If you're really aggressive, it's not unreasonable if you make a lot of income and you save a lot of money that 5-7 years from now, you couldn't have a pretty good portfolio, especially if your expenses and your kind of overhead's a little bit lower. But 10, 15 years, I think is very doable for a large number of people with very practical, doable strategies that a lot of them I laid out in the book, Retire Early with Real Estate. And that to me, that blows my mind. Like, you know, if you think about the average person who's turning 70 in the US has, I think the number is like $100,000 saved. And we're talking about people who are 25, 30, retiring when they're 40 or 45. That's crazy. Like that's very, that's a really accelerated timeline. And that's something that could get you excited. Like what do you want to do with your life? Do you want to travel? Are you working a job now, but you should be coaching basketball or you should be teaching, you should be starting a nonprofit. Like you have a lot of life ahead of you if you can start doing these kind of things right now and then anticipate being able to transition over time to doing more and more things with your time that you love to do.
Awesome.
So a lot of people put time, and here you mentioning time a lot, and how many years it's going to take to reach financial freedom. On the flip side, I believe I learned this from you, but there's a way to calculate how many doors or I guess properties you'd need to reach that fine number. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. I like to give a simple example because you can get more complicated with it, but why not keep it simple, right? So let's just say you had 10 units. These could be like 5 duplexes. It could be one 10 unit building. It could be 10 single family houses. But let's just say each one of those units rented for $1,000 or let's say $1,200 per month. So that's the total rent you're collecting. And after you pay all of your expenses, so taxes, insurance, maintenance, capital expenses, management, everything except for your mortgage payment, because we're going to assume in this case, we paid all our debt off on these 10 properties. Let's say we had $600 left over every month. So that, would that seem reasonable for you guys? Like you make $1,200 in rent, left over $600. That's pretty conservative, right? So if you have 10 properties times $600, I like to do really simple math. That's $6,000 per month that these 10 properties will pay you. And so all you need, the question you need to ask yourself is
$72,000 a year, right?
Is $72,000 per year. Will that cover the expenses that I need to cover today? And if it is, then your number is 10 properties. What you need to do is go out during the acquisitions phase and buy at least 10 properties that fit that category. Maybe you buy a few extras so that you can sell some off and help you kind of accelerate the deal and pay things off faster. But that's really a simple plan as I try to recommend to people is shoot for a number of properties. Don't worry about being too precise because you know things are going to change 5, 6, 7 years from now. But just work it backwards from the number of properties. And over the next 3 to 4 years, 5 years maybe, make it your goal to acquire those properties. That's all. That's your single-minded focus. And then once you get to those properties, now transition to a new phase, which is paying the properties off or refinancing them, stabilizing them. You know, that's a really simple plan. You can make it more complicated if you want. You could buy 30 properties instead of 10 and have more leverage. But you're welcome to do whichever variations you want. But my message is you could have a super simple portfolio like that and it could achieve financial independence. And the same timeline we're talking about, you know, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. That's the kind of timeline a lot of people, if you really focus on the acquisitions and then the payoff, that's what you could do.
Cool. Awesome. We respect your time here. So we want to go into the last segment of our show, which is called The Last Drop, but I'm going to ask you a question, but I want to plug your book and just talk about a little bit about why it resonated so much with me. Chad's book, Retire Early with Real Estate. And it was the first book that I read that hooked me on real estate was Rich Dad Poor Dad, which I think everyone talks about. But Chad's book, Retire Early with Real Estate, was the one that framed it to me like, oh, wait a second. I personally, me, Corey, can do this. And it wasn't just like a fictitious, you know, something to look at, like you said, up the mountain. And the reason is because the case studies that you had in this book, where you had, I think, 40 or 50 people come in, and in the audiobook, you could tell that these people were from all walks of life, all over the place, and they did it themselves. And I was like, well, wait, I can do this. And I just wanted to shout out that book because seriously, it changed the framing of, well, if Sally who lives in Michigan can do this, and no offense to Sally, but I think I'm as smart or the average of all these people, I know I can do this. And I think that our listeners should be able to say the same thing. So that book was awesome. And I want to thank you for that.
Well, but, thank you. That's really cool to hear that.
Yeah. And but in this segment, The Last Drop, I want to see if you have a specific resource that you might be able to share. I know we're putting you on the spot here, that has helped you along your journey, whether that be a book or a tool, a program that our audience might be able to take away and use in their own travels.
Yeah, man, there's so many good ones. You know, I'm thinking about the basketball theme. If I can go with that, like there's a little book by John Wooden called, it's just called Wooden. And it's like this tiny little book. I got it on my shelf back there and it has so many gems. And maybe it's just cause like sports metaphors resonate with me, but John Wooden was an old school basketball coach at UCLA. And it's just like each chapter is like one page, 2 pages. And it has things like some of the, his little lessons and little quips, things like make today a masterpiece. And or success is peace of mind, knowing you gave your best. And then he explains a little story. And I say this because I think the mindset of sports is really applicable to financial independence, to real estate investing. If you look at a coach like John Wooden, he would take his players before they even started the season. And he would just focus on the tiny, tiny little things, the little tiny details. He would go in and he would, his first week of practice or the first few days of practice, he would have his guys in the locker room for an hour and a half practicing tying their shoes and putting on their socks. And I always imagine like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and like Bill Walton, these like Hall of Fame players, like getting frustrated, like sitting in there like, coach, like we're tying our shoes like 100 times and we're rolling up our socks. And he would try to get them to that exasperation point to prove a point. And he would say, you know, you guys probably think I'm focusing too much on your socks and your shoes, don't you? Like, yeah, like we want to shoot the basketball. What's going on here? And he would say, here's the thing. Do you guys want to win a championship? They're like, yeah, that's why we came to UCLA. We won a championship. He's like, well, here's how it works. If you don't put on your socks correctly, don't tie your shoes correctly, you're going to get a blister. If you get a blister, you're going to miss a day or two of practice. If you miss a day or two of practice, you're not going to play your best in one of the games. And if you don't play your best in one of the games, we might lose that game. And if we lose games, we're not going to win a championship. Therefore, I want you to put your socks on correctly. And so those are little, you know, life lessons. It's a approach to how to attack a problem, how to attack a big, huge goal like financial independence. And what John Wooden would say, put your shoes on, like tie your shoes, put on your socks. It's the same thing with real estate. It's the little things. It's, you know, how do you, the little ways of sending out letters to make an offer on or making offers on properties, the little things you do every single day. If you're working a full-time job, it's a little bit more challenging. How do you structure your schedule? Do you get up 30 minutes earlier to have a little bit extra time to work on your real estate business? Are you saying no to that extra thing that's just kind of a waste of time and is sucking out 30 minutes out of your day when you really could spend that time getting better, improving your life? And so I think those little things are so critical. And there's books like, you know, that's one of many, but a book like John Wooden, this with those kind of life lessons, find a book that resonates with you about mindset and how to approach real estate, life, basketball, whatever it is, find one of those and then go with it. Because I think beyond all the X's and O's of real estate, you're the captain of the ship. You're the one who's having to get up day in and day out. And I think the success of you sticking with this and making this thing work, that in kind of achieving these dreams you want to achieve, have a lot to do with what's inside of your head and how much you kind of work on that on a day-to-day basis.
I love it, because I think that the coaching that I do personally like helps me with every aspect of my life. And just the sports analogies to go along with that are, they're really, really powerful. Just the way you interact with people, the mentoring, the teaching. I think it helps, and we're sports guys, so obviously we do think this, but I think it helps in everything you do. And real estate is not an exception to that. So did you have anything else? I mean, this has been awesome.
It's been incredible. As you said, we respect your time. I'd like to give a few little plugs here. Resources for Chad. Chad Coach Carson. You can find him at coachcarson.com. He has a YouTube channel. I believe it's Coach Carson. You have a podcast as well, and Instagram, where you put a lot of valuable content. So he's pretty much all over the place, or all encompassing here. Chad, are we missing anything where people can interact with you if they, you know, took something out of this episode and were like, wow, we love this guy. We need to get in touch.
Oh, really appreciate you sharing that. And no, that if you go to coachcarson.com, I'm on all the social media, but Instagram in particular, I'm pretty active. And I'm trying to get the YouTube is kind of like my, if you like tutorials and how to, and like just basically me drawing on a little whiteboard and saying, here's how you do this. Here's how you, I just try to simplify it and break it down. I do a lot of that on YouTube. Podcasting is more, I have some of that too, but it's a little bit more long form. I'm interviewing a lot and I'm trying to share a lot of stories. Like I love, you know, getting different stories than me. Like I've got my one path, my one approach, but you know, how did this person do it? How did that person do it? And I really appreciated your comment about the book, because one of my goals with that was not to make it about me. I wanted to make it about all these other people. And by you saying that, I hope that really confirms that people can see themselves in this journey. Totally. And they can relate to it. And that's, you know, podcasts like yours, podcast like what I'm trying to accomplish, we're all hoping, I think, to bring people along with us. Like we don't want to have this information in our head and go hoard it or, you know, do it ourselves. Like we want to share it. And that's, you know, thank you guys for what you're doing, because you're doing awesome work and sharing on Instagram as well. I love the work you're doing. So hope we can all work together to kind of accomplish
that. Yeah, I mean, like it's great. 4 months ago, we've been into this for a while in terms of the real estate, but 4 months ago, we're like, we should start this podcast. And 4 months later, I'm talking to somebody that I read their book. It's the organic networking that comes from it, putting your message out there. It's a beautiful thing.
You're like him seeing LeBron James in real estate. He's like, you got Coach Carson?
Yeah.
So just so you know, like we slightly fanboying over here. Yeah, so super motivated by you, super inspired, and just very thankful for your time. I will say one last time, Retire Early with Real Estate by Chad Carson. You can get that wherever books are made.
Cool. Well, Ryan and Corey, I really appreciate it, guys. Y'all are awesome. And thanks for your time having me on.
Thanks so much,
Chad. Appreciate it, man.